Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill. For Thursday, April 9, the story Pentagon Turf War ramps up between Hegseth and Driscoll, a simmering battle for influence between Pete Hegseth and the Army Secretary Dan Driscoll has reached new heights with the Defense Secretary's purge of senior Army officials last week. Tensions flared when Driscoll was picked last year by President Trump to negotiate with Ukrainian officials in hopes of ending the Russia-Ukraine war, according to two former U.S. officials familiar with the dynamics. A current U.S. official said Hegseth's paranoia has been heightened in recent weeks as the president has fired two cabinet officials. He's just really uncomfortable with anyone who could potentially be outshining him, the current official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the internal dynamics, told The Hill about Hegseth. The Pentagon pushed back, saying The Hill's sources are serving up fake news to anyone gullible enough to write about it. Pentagon Chief Spokesperson Sean Parnell said in an emailed statement that Hegseth maintains excellent working relationships with the secretaries of every service branch, including Driscoll. However, a Pentagon official speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss the dynamics said Hegseth's team believes they've uncovered proof that Driscoll has become a resistance figure within the Pentagon, not only against Hegseth, but against President Trump as well. Hegseth, the former infantry platoon leader who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, has axed more than a dozen senior military officials who had backed diversity efforts he derided as woke or viewed as too cozy with the previous administration. Hegseth's firing of Driscoll's widely respected Chief of Staff General Randy George, along with two other senior military officials last week, stunned defense officials as the U.S. is engaged in a war against Iran, the current official said. The firing came on the heels of the Pentagon chief ending the suspension of the Army crew who flew a pair of military helicopters near Kid Rock's house in Tennessee, undercutting an Army investigation into the incident. The ouster of George prompted some Republicans to rally behind the decorated general who deployed in support of Desert Shield, Desert Storm, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and Operation Enduring Freedom. On Capitol Hill, it has shaken some GOP lawmakers who have largely backed Hegseth, despite a series of scandals during his tenure, according to the first former U.S. official, who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of retribution. There's concern about the state and health of DOW going forward if you get rid of good, really good generals for no reason, and therefore they have concerns about Hegseth himself, the first official said, referring to the Department of War, the administration's preferred name for the Department of Defense. Driscoll, meanwhile, has won plaudits from both sides of the aisle among the three service secretaries, including the heads of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. Driscoll is doing the best job, a Democratic congressional aide told The Hill on Wednesday. After Hegseth's rocky confirmation process, in which Democrats blasted his past issues with alcohol and infidelity, the defense secretary's first rough patch at the Pentagon came when he shared sensitive military information in a Signal group chat that included the Atlantic's editor-in-chief. That was the first time Hegseth became concerned about his standing in the cabinet and on alert for leaks to the media, according to the second former official. Driscoll, a close ally of Vice President Vance, has long been rumored as a potential successor to Hegseth should he get fired. He sees that Driscoll is a natural successor to him, the second ex-official said, adding that the White House told Hegseth that he cannot get rid of the Army Secretary. Instead, Hegseth has sought to sideline and undercut Driscoll with moves like the firing of George and another one of Driscoll's top advisors, Colonel Dave Butler, 2 months ago. It's a way for him to, look, I'm going to signal that I'm in charge of your people. I'm going to try to undermine your leadership, the current official said, adding Hegseth is just trying to knock the Army down a few pegs so that he feels safer. The White House lauded both political appointees when asked about Driscoll's standing. President Trump has effectively restored a focus on readiness and lethality across our military with the help of leaders like Secretary Hegseth and Secretary Driscoll, White House spokesperson Anna Kelly said in a statement to The Hill on Wednesday. George was reportedly directly involved in another flashpoint between Hegseth and Driscoll last week when the Pentagon secretary quashed the suspension of the crew who flew the AH-64 Apache helicopter near Kid Rock's estate in Nashville. Some Democrats on the House Armed Services Committee told The Hill that the service branch should have been left alone to conduct a probe and mete out punishment as appropriate. George, who has more than four decades of experience in the Army, was also in favor of the probe, the Washington Post reported Tuesday. Retired Marine Colonel William Dunn took a similar stance in comments to The Hill last week. He said an investigation wasn't necessary given the obvious violation of Army code, but that it wasn't Hegseth's call either way. No one should intervene with the squadron commander's prerogative to discipline his pilots. Having the SecBor step in to stop discipline is a bad precedent. It doesn't matter if it's Kid Rock's house, he said in an email. We have rules and procedures set in place to keep people on the ground safe, as well as to protect the pilots. The friction between Hegseth and Driscoll has also come up over these defense secretaries blocking promotions of military officers, according to current and former officials. Former officials said that with Trump ousting Kristi Noem, the former Department of Homeland Secretary and Attorney General Pam Bondi, Hegseth is increasingly worried about being removed. The first former U.S. official said they do not think Trump will swap out Hegseth during the war with Iran, but that Driscoll has been mentioned in circles if the secretary was ever left for whatever reason, that Driscoll was high on the list of potential replacements. Asked about the tension with Hegseth, Driscoll said in a statement to The Hill, I have no plans to depart or resign as the Secretary of the Army. Serving under President Trump has been the honor of a lifetime, and I remain laser-focused on providing America with the strongest land-fighting force the world has ever seen, he added. Kevin Carroll, a retired Army Reserve colonel who has served in the offices of Secretary of Defense and on the Joint Staff, said Driscoll does not appear to be actively trying to undermine Hegseth's authority or public image. From what I've seen in the press and from whatever it's worth, what I hear from people in the Army, it's not like Driscoll is scheming and plotting to make Hegseth look bad. I mean, Hegseth takes care of that himself on a regular basis. It's all just very strange, and it's just irresponsible, Carroll said in an interview with The Hill. The Pentagon official disputed that assessment, claiming the White House had sidelined Driscoll for fumbling Ukraine negotiations. In the past few weeks, insiders in Driscoll's office have been telling Hegseth and his team about strategy sessions led by Driscoll for the purpose of how to best undermine the secretary and the administration, they said. Hegseth has tried to work with Driscoll in good faith and play nice, but Driscoll's subversion has made the relationship untenable. A source with knowledge told The Hill on Wednesday that they are not sure where the information is coming from, adding Driscoll is closely involved in the negotiations with Ukrainian officials. Parnell, the Pentagon's top spokesperson, has told some within the department privately that he is interested in Driscoll's post if it opens up. According to a current and former U.S. official, Parnell's interest was first reported by the New York Post. Parnell did not respond to The Hill's request for comment on his ambitions. An administration official speaking on a condition of anonymity told The Hill on Wednesday that anyone claiming Sean is pushing himself for Driscoll's post is obvious outsider spewing nonsense. Every senior leader in the department knows Sean is laser-focused on his current roles, including the head of the Pentagon's Afghanistan Withdrawal Special Review Panel and the department's recruiting task force, and is not looking for another role and has zero time for political gamesmanship, they added. Parnell ran in Pennsylvania for a House seat in 2020, but lost to former Representative Connor Lamb, Democrat. The next year he ran for Senate with the endorsement of Trump, but ended his campaign amid a legal battle with his estranged wife, who accused him of abuse. Parnell has denied any wrongdoing. So far, the commander-in-chief has expressed steadfast public support for both Hegseth and Driscoll. All I can say is that he was treated very unfairly, and now those same people that treated him unfairly, that fought against him, they called me up saying what a great choice he was, Trump said of Hegseth during a Monday press conference at the White House. I'm telling you, people that were not for him, senators, friends of mine, sir, I don't think you're doing the right thing now to call me up. What a choice, he added. The story, Johnson faces rocky weeks of lassoing frustrated House Republicans for major bills. Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, faces a tough task in the coming weeks in trying to lasso House Republicans to pass two high-stakes bills that are dividing and enraging the conference. Johnson will aim to pass a clean reauthorization of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Acts, or FISA, foreign surveillance powers next week, ahead of an April 20 expiration, with rebellious Republicans seeking reforms and unrelated measures as part of it. He may have to look to Democrats to advance the bill. Meanwhile, fury from Republicans over a leadership-endorsed two-step plan to end the record-long Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, shutdown is complicating how fast Republicans can act to fund the department, and the dispute is not likely to be settled next week. On top of that, Republican leaders are bracing for GOP defections that could usher through a Democratic-led resolution to limit President Trump's war powers in Iran, which has a good chance of getting enough support to pass as members of both parties lose patience over the conflict. For Johnson, the compounding challenges are part of the realities of managing a slim majority in which he can afford no more than one or two Republican defections on party-line measures, and absences can make the difference between a measure passing or failing. But they also arrive at a critical moment with major bills on the docket and increasing GOP worries about the fast-approaching midterms. He's dealt with these cards, said Representative Tim Burkett of Tennessee, who is often one of the Republican holdouts, complicating passage of the measures on the House floor. He's sitting there with a one-person majority. Burkett, though, is among the Republican members who are not committed to voting for a clean 18-month reauthorization of Section 702 of FISA, which authorizes surveillance of foreign nationals outside the U.S. Representative Ana Paulina Luna, Republican of Florida, has been leading the charge to oppose the bill unless it includes the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility or Save America Act, a suite of Trump-endorsed voting reforms that would require proof of citizenship to register to vote and voter ID to cast a ballot. Burkett echoed that he will not support the bill if the Save America Act is not in the mix. Several other Republicans, meanwhile, have said they want further reforms to FISA powers, even though Johnson has argued that reforms enacted in 2024 to protect Americans' data have been effective. That opposition complicates the path for the bill to get to the floor. Johnson would need near unanimous support from Republicans on a procedural rule vote to tee up the bill in a regular process. To circumvent that, he could use the suspension of the rules process, which would require support from two-thirds of the House to pass, but it was unclear enough Democrats would support a clean reauthorization, and relying on Democrats could peeve House Republicans. Johnson already has had to push back plans to pass the measure once because of the uncertainty of the vote count. Punchbowl News, however, reported this week that House Intelligence Committee ranking member Jim Himes, Democrat of Connecticut, signaled to Democratic colleagues he would support a clean reauthorization in a good sign for Johnson's hopes of passing the FISA bill. FISA is just the first hurdle that Johnson will have to clear the coming weeks, though. The toughest task will be corralling his conference behind a plan to reopen DHS, with Democrats refusing to vote to fund immigration enforcement without major reforms, and Republicans unable to find an agreement on those points. Trump last week endorsed a plan to fund immigration and customs enforcement, or ICE and Border Patrol, the two areas being held up by Democrats demanding reforms for the remainder of his term. through the special budget reconciliation process, which would circumvent the Democratic Senate filibuster. Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, soon after issued a joint statement in support of a two-step plan to pass a bipartisan Senate bill to fund the bulk of DHS followed by ICE and Border Patrol in reconciliation. That gave many House Republicans whiplash after Johnson just the week before slammed the Senate bill as a joke and got House Republicans to pass a DHS stopgap instead. Other members warned about the precedent of splitting up a regular appropriations bill. GOP members fumed over the situation in a lengthy conference call last week, with many of them calling to see action on a reconciliation bill before passing the bipartisan Senate deal that would fund the Transportation Security Administration, Coast Guard, and Federal Emergency Management Agency. "It's very concerning to go ahead and pass the funding bill the Senate passed and just say we're going to get it done in reconciliation," said Representative Marlon Stutzman, Republican of Indiana. "I mean, we need to have some strong assurances that that actually happens. The Senate obviously put us all in a very awkward position," he added. "And you know, I know that we're on the side with the president." The House Freedom Caucus this week went even further, calling to fund DHS entirely through budget reconciliation. The sequencing matters, Representative Chip Roy, Republican of Texas, said on Fox News over the weekend while calling to pass full DHS funding through reconciliation. "A lot of us are not going to be comfortable moving an appropriations bill that does not fund ICE and Border Patrol based on a bet that we're going to move a reconciliation package. If Republicans pass full DHS funding through reconciliation," Roy argued, "at least then we won't be sending a message that somehow ICE and Border Patrol are different and shouldn't get the full funding." Trump last week signed an order to pay all DHS employees despite the shutdown, relieving some pressure to rush any package through Congress over objections of GOP members. But Johnson will have to huddle with his members and Senate leadership when Congress returns to grapple with those demands and find a path forward for DHS funding. The story: GOP lawmakers praise Trump-Iran deal, but caution about path forward. Republicans are hailing President Trump's two-week ceasefire deal with Iran, but many caution the temporary and fragile truce is only a first step and that the U.S. needs to do more to secure American interests and advance lasting peace. Trump sent shockwaves across the nation Tuesday when he announced a two-week suspension of hostilities after warning that a whole civilization will die tonight if Iran didn't cut a deal and reopen the Strait of Hormuz by 8 p.m. that night. The dramatic pivot quickly quelled fears among Republicans, some of whom had criticized his earlier threats, as they framed the ceasefire as a diplomatic win for the U.S. Still, uncertainty surrounding the deal, including the impact of Israeli strikes on Lebanon on Wednesday, Iran's reported closure of the Strait of Hormuz, and ongoing tensions between both sides have left GOP lawmakers warning that Trump and negotiators will need to take considerable steps in the coming days to stabilize the situation. Representative Don Bacon, Republican of Nebraska, emphasized in an interview with CNN on Wednesday that the conflict is far from over. "Here's the concern. The government's still in place, and we should be negotiating from a position of strength, not a position that's good for them. But what worries me is if they remain in place and they hate us, and when I say these people, the IRGC, the Ayatollahs, the mullahs, they will work with Russia and China as soon as they can to start rebuilding their military, and they will be a threat 5, 6, 7, 8 years down the road," he said. Questions emerged almost immediately about the strength of the ceasefire. Israel on Wednesday launched its most significant military campaign in Lebanon since it began fighting Tehran-backed Hezbollah militants, while the sides publicly disagreed on whether Lebanon was included in the ceasefire deal. The U.S. Gulf allies in Bahrain, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates, meanwhile, reported Iranian attacks on Wednesday. Saudi Arabia reported intercepting 9 Iranian drones. Iranian state media has also reported Wednesday that Tehran closed down the Strait of Hormuz, through which roughly 20% of the world's oil supply passes, in response to Israel's assault in Lebanon. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt dismissed those reports at her press briefing, accusing Iran of lying. Iran had sent over a 10-point response to the U.S. aimed at ending the conflict, which Trump said Tuesday evening was a workable basis on which to negotiate. But the Iranian parliamentary speaker, Mohammad Bagar Kalibaf, accused the U.S. of violating 3 key clauses on the social platform X. When asked if he thought there was a deal amid the Iranian attacks and the fact that its leaders are still in control of the strait, Bacon told CNN, "I am not sure there's a deal. It will have to. That will bear out in the next 24-48 hours. But if they keep firing, we still have more targets that we can hit in Iran." Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, a top Iran hawk in Congress, wrote on X earlier Wednesday that a diplomatic solution to end the reign of terror in Iran is the preferred outcome. The supposed negotiating document, in my view, has some troubling aspects, but time will tell. He also called for a congressional review process, like the one the Senate followed to test the Obama-Iranian deal, fair and challenging questions with a full opportunity to explain, and a healthy dose of sunlight is generally the right formula to understand any matter, he wrote. Representative Randy Fine, Republican of Florida, an outspoken supporter of Israel, said he trusted Trump to navigate us into a long-term sustainable solution. A 2-week ceasefire is not an end. It is a pause to try to get to a solution, he said. Fine said the U.S.'s key objectives are to ensure the Iranian government gives up the desire to have nuclear weapons and halts efforts in building the capability to deliver that nuclear weapon. It's a very tenuous time, and we will see how it shakes out, but I think the threat that President Trump made is a good one. Either heal or die, that is the choice they will have, Fine said. It's not our job to be nation building, and we haven't done a good job of it when we've tried in the past. Our job is to be America first, which means protecting American interest and making sure Iran can't nuke us. That's about as America first as it gets, he added. Both Democrats and Republicans have called for congressional briefings on the operation. Democrats in particular have railed against Trump's handling of the conflict, even aiming to bring measures to the floor that would limit Trump's war powers. House Democrats are aiming to pass such a resolution by unanimous consent during a pro forma session on Thursday, while Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, said the upper chamber will vote on an Iran war powers resolution next week. Our country is worse off because of Trump's strategic ineptitude. Enough is enough. Pass the war powers resolution, end the war, Schumer wrote on X. But Republicans expressed optimism that there will be brighter days ahead, emphasizing that several U.S. objectives in the conflict have already been met. I think it's very important to realize that this president, his strength is in negotiations, and if you underestimate him, that's at your own peril. He is very good at winning, maybe the best ever that we've ever had at winning, Representative Jimmy Petronas, Republican of Florida, said. There's been a nice collective effort to all the Middle Eastern countries that have come together and have been enduring this battle at the same time, standing by the United States through the end. So I really think, you know, Iran is outnumbered in this, and I do think, you know, brighter days, safer days, more prosperous days are ahead of us, he added. Bacon told The Hill that our best in state is a government friendly to the U.S., respects its people, and backs away from nuclear program. If that cannot be done, we've at least degraded Iran's capabilities for years to come, he said. The story: automatic registration for U.S. military draft to begin in December. Eligible men will automatically be registered into the military draft pool By December, as part of an effort to streamline the previous process of self-registration and save money, the Selective Service System, or SSS, the government agency that maintains a database of men to be called up to serve in the case of a national emergency, submitted a proposed rule to the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs on March 30, according to the office's website. Most men between the ages of 18 and 25 are already required to register with the Selective Service, but automatic registration was mandated in December 2025 as part of the Fiscal 2026 National Defense Authorization Act. The change, which was meant to save money, transfers responsibility for registration from individual men to SSS through integration with federal data sources. According to the website, the proposed rule is currently under review by the Regulatory Affairs Office and awaiting finalization. The U.S. has not had a draft since the Vietnam War, with military service being voluntary since 1973. But former President Jimmy Carter in 1980 reinstated the Selective Service in the event of a national emergency, where the registry could be used to provide personnel to the Department of War, an alternative service for conscientious objectors, if authorized by the President and Congress. Many have questioned whether a U.S. military draft could take place amid the war in Iran, which is currently in a tenuous two-week ceasefire. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt in March said that while a draft is not part of the current plan right now, President Trump wisely keeps his options on the table. Trump alone cannot bring back the draft through executive action, as Congress would need to pass legislation to amend the Military Selective Service Act to authorize the president to induct personnel into the military. Still, failure to register in the draft is considered a crime and can prevent people from receiving state-funded financial aid, and employment in numerous states cause ineligibility for many federal employment opportunities and job training under the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and can carry a fine of up to $250,000 and jail time for up to 5 years. In addition, immigrants who don't register may lose their U.S. citizenship. Under the new rule, men will be registered automatically within 30 days of their 18th birthdays. Women are still ineligible for the draft, even as lawmakers in the past few years have attempted to attach provisions adding women to the draft as part of the annual defense policy bill. The measures have all been stripped out before a final vote on the legislation. The story is the memo column, Trump's dash for off-ramp in Iran fuels fears of strategic defeat. There are huge questions hanging over the Trump administration's strategic objectives in Iran, especially now that a tentative ceasefire has hit immediate turbulence. Global relief on Tuesday evening when President Trump backed off his ominous threat to lay waste to Iranian civilization gave way to uncertainty and confusion Wednesday. A key figure in Tehran, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mohammad Bagar Kalibaf, complained in a social media post that Washington had immediately violated three terms of the tentative deal, notably by excluding the situation in Lebanon from the ceasefire agreement. Israel has invaded southern Lebanon, asserting it is seeking to counter the militant group Hezbollah, which is widely viewed as an Iranian proxy. More than 1,500 people have been killed in this phase of the conflict in Lebanon, according to local authorities, and more than 1 million people have been displaced. Kalibaf contended that the alleged violations by the U.S. meant that a bilateral ceasefire or negotiations is unreasonable. A spokesperson for the Iranian Foreign Ministry, Ismail Bakai, also posted a short clip of White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt telling reporters Lebanon was not part of the ceasefire deal during Wednesday's media briefing. Bakai asserted that this statement amounted to early reneging by the U.S. For now, however, negotiations set for later this week in Pakistan appear to remain on schedule. At the briefing, Leavitt confirmed that Vice President Vance would lead the U.S. delegation in those talks. The back and forth over Lebanon is only one part of the broader uncertainty around how much Trump really achieved during the roughly 6-week war. However, Trump and other senior figures in the administration, such as Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, insist that the United States has won an emphatic victory in Iran since it began its strikes in conjunction with Israel on February 28. They point to the thousands of targets hit and to the enormous degradation of Iran's Navy and Air Force. But no one had any doubt that the U.S. military is far more powerful than the Iranian armed forces. From the outset of the conflict, skeptics had warned about Tehran's capacity to wage asymmetrical warfare, finding pressure points and intensifying the pain to a level its adversaries were unwilling to bear. This is precisely what happens to have happened in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has been able to exercise effective control over the narrow shipping channel through which around 20% of the world's oil typically transits. The de facto Iranian blockade sent oil prices soaring, pushed the price of gas at the pump up by roughly a dollar over the course of a month for Americans, and caused tremors in financial markets around the world. Oil prices fell like a stone when Trump's seeming acquiescence to a ceasefire became public Tuesday evening, but the fact remains that the U.S. has not been able to wrest control of the strait from the Iranians. Reading between the lines of Trump's words, that appears unlikely to change in a fundamental way anytime soon. The midnight social media posts from the president included the assertion that the U.S. will be helping with the traffic buildup in the Strait of Hormuz. There will be lots of positive action. Big money will be made. Jonathan Carl of ABC News posted on social media that he had asked Trump on Wednesday morning whether the president could accept a scenario in which Iran charged the toll for ships passing through the strait. According to Carl, Trump responded, "We're thinking of doing it as a joint venture." Levitt at the briefing emphasized that process toward a longer-term settlement of the crisis was contingent upon the strait remaining open with no limitations or delays. But that language implicitly acknowledged that Iran could indeed limit or delay shipping, a massive strategic lever for it to retain. Similarly, one of the core U.S. aims in the war was supposedly to prevent Iran from ever having the capacity to manufacture a nuclear weapon. Iran, for its part, says it is seeking nuclear technology only for peaceful purposes. Their desire and their plan to build a nuclear bomb inside their country is no longer going to be allowed, Levitt said. But Iran remains in possession of its stock of highly enriched uranium. According to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Iran possesses around 970 pounds of the potent substance. In recent days, Trump and Hegseth have both emphasized their claims that the material is under close U.S. surveillance. "It's buried and we're watching it. We know exactly what they have," Hegseth told reporters at a Pentagon briefing Wednesday morning. He also added, "They will either give it to us or we'll take it out." But Iran, which has been sounding a defiant tone, appears highly unlikely to simply hand it over. There is, of course, one final and overarching problem for Trump and for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The Islamic Republic has accomplished its most elemental goals, survival. Predictions that U.S. and Israeli bombardments would embolden Iranian dissenters to take down the regime were wrong so far. The killing on day one of former Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei only saw him replaced by his son Mojtaba Khamenei. The theocratic leadership in Tehran never seems to have been at real risk of losing its grip on power. Militarily, there is no question at all that Iran has taken a serious battering, but strategically it has won merely by not losing and by showing it has the capacity to inflict serious pain and pressure on the West. The lesson won't be forgotten anytime soon in Washington or Tehran. The story, more New Yorkers back Mamdani, but say city on wrong track. The plurality of New York voters approve of the job Mayor Zohran Mamdani, Democrat, is doing in office, but nearly 60% say their city is on the wrong track, according to a new poll released Thursday. In the survey conducted by Emerson College Polling and PIX 11, 43% of the city's registered voters approve of Mamdani's job performance, while 27% disapprove. Another 30% are neutral. In the city's first Democratic Socialist mayor approaches his 100th day in office, Mamdani finds more support from registered voters who participated in the November 2025 election than from those who opted not to vote at all. Among those registered voters who voted in the November mayoral election, Mamdani's support is stronger, with a net 26-point positive approval rating. 55% approve, 29% disapprove, compared to a more modest 9-point net a positive rating. Among those who did not vote, 35% approve, 26% disapprove. Spencer Kimball, executive director of Emerson College Polling, said in a statement, "The results of the two-day Emerson survey, which concluded Monday, are similar to a poll released Wednesday from the Marist Institute for Public Opinion, which found 48% of New York City residents approving of Mamdani's job performance, 30% disapproving, and 23% saying they're not sure. Even as Mamdani enjoys a net positive approval rating in both surveys, a majority of registered voters in the Emerson survey, at 59%, say New York City is on the wrong track, while 41% say the city is headed in the right direction. In the Marist poll, meanwhile, 56% of residents said things were moving in the right direction, and 43% disagreed. New Yorkers in both surveys largely agreed that Mamdani was focusing on issues important to them, including 59% of registered voters in the Emerson survey. In that latest survey, a majority of New York voters at 54% approve of the way Mamdani is handling child care, compared to 21% who disapprove. 49% approve of his handling of housing affordability, compared to 25% who disapprove. 45% approve of his handling of public safety, compared to 32% who disapprove, and 40% approve of Mamdani's handling of the city's budget, compared to 37% who disapprove. In the Marist poll of New York residents, 74% said Mamdani is working hard as mayor, 61% said he understands the problems facing the city, is a good leader, cares about people like them, and is doing more to unite the city than divide it, and 60% said the mayor is fulfilling his campaign promises. The Emerson College polling survey, which included 850 New York City registered voters, was conducted on April 5 through 6 and had a margin of error of 3.4 percentage points. The story is the Hill's Morning Report. Vance takes center stage in faltering Iran ceasefire. In today's issue, Trump, Iran agree to two-week ceasefire. NATO's Rutte visits Washington. Liberal candidate flips Wisconsin court seat. Abducted journalist freed. Vice President Vance has quickly become a central figure in trying to maintain a shaky ceasefire in a war that he has repeatedly been skeptical about from the start. Vance is set to travel to Islamabad, Pakistan, on Saturday, along with U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as the trio attempt to cement a two-week ceasefire and bring an end to hostilities with Iran that have persisted for nearly 6 weeks. The truce announced by Trump on Tuesday night is off to a troubled start, with Iran continuing to fire on Gulf states on Wednesday and Israel launching waves of deadly strikes on Lebanon. Vance's deep reservations about foreign entanglements as a veteran of the Iraq War seems to have given him credibility with Iranian officials who have lost trust in Witkoff and Kushner after failed talks before the war. No one in the president's inner circle was more concerned about the prospect of war with Iran or did more to advise against it than the vice president, the New York Times reported on Tuesday. He reportedly cautioned during a high-level meeting in February that a war on Iran could cause regional chaos, alienate Trump's supporters, and deplete U.S. weapons stockpiles. He thought a war to enact regime change would fail and pushed for limited but overwhelming action, aware that Trump intended to intervene in some way. 2 months later, Vance is the point man in efforts to bring an end to the conflict. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told Al Jazeera in an interview last week before the ceasefire was reached that he had received messages from Witkoff concerning peace talks, but the trust level is at zero. A source told Reuters at the time that Trump authorized Vance to communicate with intermediaries that the U.S. would be open to a ceasefire in exchange for a reopening of the Strait of Hormuz and other demands. with the president's deadline for Iran to agree to open the strait or face devastating attacks on its energy infrastructure approaching Tuesday, Vance was involved in securing the deal, having played a key role in talks from the start, according to White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt. Israel, which wasn't a party in those talks but agreed to halt attacks on Iran, instead pounded Lebanon, where it is fighting Hezbollah, Iran's most powerful proxy group. On Wednesday, Israel struck major commercial and residential areas in central Beirut, killing more than 250 people, according to Lebanese authorities, in the deadliest day of the conflict. Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Lebanon is not part of the ceasefire. Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, who mediated the talks, said it is. Iranian leaders pointed to Sharif's public statement in arguing Israel was violating the ceasefire and announced the Strait of Hormuz would remain closed until the attacks stop. Vance sought to play damage control on Wednesday afternoon, calling it a legitimate misunderstanding. In remarks to reporters, The Hill's Julia Manchester reports, "I think that the Iranians thought that the ceasefire included Lebanon, and it just didn't. We never made that promise," he said. That said, the Israelis, as I understand it, have actually offered to frankly check themselves a little bit in Lebanon because they want to make sure that our negotiation is successful. Aragachi said the U.S. must choose between the ceasefire or continued war. "I cannot have both," the foreign minister said in a post on the social platform X. "The world sees the massacres in Lebanon. The ball is in the U.S. court, and the world is watching whether it will act on its commitments." Meanwhile, Iranian-backed militias in Iraq have launched drone attacks on major areas, leading the State Department to advise Americans to leave the country. And multiple Gulf states said Wednesday that they have intercepted missiles and drones from Iran. Vance's role as peacemaker has already brought skepticism from hawkish figures in Trump's coalition. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, one of Trump's top advocates in Congress, expressed concern about the basis for the talks. "I look forward to the architects of this proposal, the vice president and others, coming forward to Congress and explaining how a negotiated deal meets our national security objectives in Iran," Graham said in a post on X. With Vance, who has been viewed as a potential frontrunner for the GOP presidential nomination in 2028, can help keep the president's base together amid what has been a divisive conflict, will be tested in the weeks and months ahead. This moment could be an opportunity for the vice president to prove himself on the global stage less than a year before the next presidential election cycle gets underway, but it's off to a rocky start. Smart take with Blake Berman. One of the immediate impacts of the ceasefire with Iran could be seen in crude oil prices, which are back below $100. There's typically a lag time between those prices and the price you eventually pay at the pump. I asked Clayton Siegel, a senior fellow of energy security at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, when drivers across America could see lower prices. "I think it's going to take a period of a couple to 3 months once those exports from the Gulf area resume, but we don't even know when they're going to resume," Siegel told me. "With gasoline prices, unfortunately, they go up like a rocket and down like a feather. Another factor is when the shipping operators will feel comfortable sending their vessels full of inventory through the strait. You'll hear a lot of discussion about who controls the strait. Well, what matters most for markets is when the companies are willing to proceed forward. Three things to know today. Eligible men will start being automatically registered into the military draft pool by December instead of registering themselves to streamline the process and save money. The draft hasn't been in place since the Vietnam War, but the selective service continues in the event of national emergency." Trump lashed out at NATO again, following a meeting with Secretary General Mark Rutte, saying the alliance wasn't there when we needed them. Rutte said his talks with the president were a frank, very open discussion. The next gross domestic product report, covering the last quarter of 2025, will be released this morning, giving an updated picture of the economy towards the end of Trump's first year back in office. Leading the day, no show, former Attorney General Pam Bondi will not comply with the subpoena she was issued to appear before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee for its Jeffrey Epstein investigation, raising questions about next steps. The committee's Republican leadership said in a statement that the Department of Justice, or DOJ, stated Bondi won't appear for the deposition scheduled for Tuesday because she is no longer Attorney General and was subpoenaed in that capacity. But Democrats on the panel have rejected that argument, noting that Bondi was mentioned by name in the subpoena. They also pointed to other former attorneys general who have testified. Now that Pam Bondi has been fired, she's trying to get out of her legal obligation to testify before the Oversight Committee about the Epstein files and the White House cover-up. Representative Robert Garcia of California, the highest-ranking Democrat on the panel, said in a statement. A committee spokesperson said the panel will contact Bondi's personal counsel to discuss the next steps concerning rescheduling her deposition. The DOJ asked Oversight Committee Chair James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, in a letter obtained by The Hill to confirm the subpoena is withdrawn. The department also argued a compulsory process is unnecessary in light of our demonstrated willingness to voluntarily assist your oversight efforts. Bondi and Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, who has taken over Bondi's role in an acting capacity, met with lawmakers behind closed doors last month to discuss the Epstein files. Democrats stormed out of the meeting, noting that Bondi wasn't speaking under oath and accusing her of trying to get out of having to comply with the subpoena. The committee's Democrats argue only a vote by the panel can withdraw the subpoena. Every Democrat and four Republicans on the panel voted to issue it. If Bondi refuses to comply, the committee and then the full House could vote to hold her in contempt and call for her to face charges. But the decision to prosecute would ultimately come down to Trump's DOJ, which is now led by Blanche. War powers pro forma. Democrats will attempt to pass a resolution restricting Trump's war authority by unanimous consent on the House floor today. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York, announced the plan Wednesday to push the war powers vote during a pro forma session Thursday. Pro forma sessions typically only last a few minutes and feature a member gaveling in and gaveling out of session. The attempt will almost certainly fail as Republican leadership will likely object to the unanimous request. Jeffries said a two-week ceasefire is woefully insufficient and the House should return from recess immediately to permanently end the war. The Senate is expected to hold its own war powers vote next week. Once the upper chamber returns, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, said Wednesday. Similar votes have previously failed in the body. Still, some Republicans have expressed growing impatience with a war that never received congressional approval. IPOC on blast, a key meeting for the Democratic National Committee, or DNC, in New Orleans, starting today, may reignite tensions within the party over Israel and the role that the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or IPOC, is playing in U.S. politics. Members are expected to consider a resolution denouncing IPOC's large spending and congressional races, which has drawn increased scrutiny in recent years. Most recently, it received attention for the millions its associated super PACs played in a New Jersey special election and Illinois primaries. The group's involvement has led several prominent Democrats who were once supportive of IPOC to turn against the pro-Israel lobbying organization. It also comes as polls show Democrats and Americans overall have become less sympathetic to Israel compared with Palestinians amid the war in Gaza. The DNC will also hold debate on various other resolutions, including whether to recognize a Palestinian state or back conditions on military aid to Israel, Semaphore reported. A dozen states will also lobby members as they seek to gain an early spot in the next nominating process for the 2028 presidential race. The meeting will run from today through Saturday. Gilgo Beach Guilt. The man accused of torturing and killing seven women and leaving most of their remains near Gilgo Beach on Long Island has pleaded guilty. The reversal from 62-year-old Rex Howerman ends decades of questions as police search for a serial killer. The women who Howerman admitted to kidnapping were killed between 1993 and 2010. If the judge accepts his plea, Howerman will spend the rest of his life in prison. His sentencing has been scheduled for June 17. Howerman also agreed to admit to intentionally killing an eighth woman, Karen Vergata, in 1996. Police tracked down Howerman and arrested him in 2023 after more than a decade of searching. AI battle. A federal appeals court has rejected a bid from the AI company Anthropic to immediately block the Pentagon's labeling of it as a supply chain risk, but granted a request to move the case along an expedited schedule. The decision overturns a federal judge's ruling that had temporarily blocked the supply chain risk designation late last month. Oral arguments in the case are set for May 19. Anthropic and the Pentagon have been locked in a dispute over the use of the company's AI model Claude and whether the company can impose safety guardrails on how it's deployed. Anthropic has insisted on its model not be used for mass surveillance on Americans or fully autonomous lethal weapons, while the Pentagon has said it should be allowed to use it for all lawful uses. Defense Leaks, a former Army employee who had top secret clearance, has been charged with leaking classified information, the DOJ said Wednesday. A grand jury indicted 40-year-old Courtney Williams of Wagram, North Carolina, on charges tied to allegedly transmitting classified national defense information to individuals not authorized to receive it, including a journalist. Williams was arrested Tuesday. The DOJ said in a release that Williams worked for a special military unit from 2010 to 2016, during which she had daily access to a broad range of classified information. The indictment alleges she repeatedly communicated with a journalist between 2022 and 2025, sharing classified national defense information. The department also alleges Williams disclosed unauthorized national defense information on her social media accounts. Reuters reported journalist Seth Harp published a book last year called The Fort Bragg Cartel, Drug Trafficking and Murder in the Special Forces, and an accompanying article naming Williams as a source. Harp released a statement following the indictment calling Williams a courageous whistleblower who exposed rampant gender discrimination and sexual harassment in the U.S. Army's Delta Force, the outlet reported. In the where and when, the president will participate in executive time at 8 a.m. He will receive an intelligence briefing at 11 a.m. and participate in policy meetings at 1:30 p.m. and 2 p.m. He will participate in a Make America Healthy Again roundtable at 4 p.m. and additional policy meetings at 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. The House will convene at 11:30 a.m. for a pro forma session. The Senate will meet at noon for a pro forma session. Zoom in. Turf war, a battle between Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Army Secretary Dan Driscoll, is heating up after the Pentagon chief purged multiple top Army officials last week. The Hill's Philippe Tomatija reports tensions flared when Trump selected Driscoll last year to negotiate with Ukrainian officials to try to end the Russia-Ukraine war, according to two former U.S. officials familiar with the dynamics. And a current U.S. official said Hegseth's paranoia has been heightened in recent weeks in response to Trump's firing of two cabinet officials. He's just really uncomfortable with anyone who could potentially be outshining him, the official said. The Pentagon pushed back on the notion of tensions between the two leaders, saying the defense secretary maintains excellent working relationships with the secretaries of every service branch, including Driscoll. But the official said Hegseth's firing of the Army's chief of staff, General Randy George, and two other senior military officials last week stunned defense officials. George's ouster prompted some Republicans to rally behind him. Adding to Hegseth's anxiety is that Driscoll has been rumored as a potential successor to Hegseth should he be fired, sources said. One former official said the White House has told Hegseth he can't oust Driscoll, so he's seeking to undercut him in other ways. Elsewhere, influencer for Congress, social media personality Dan Bilzerian, has filed paperwork to challenge Representative Randy Fine, Republican of Florida, for re-election, opposing him in the Republican primary. A Federal Election Commission filing lists Bill Zerines, candidacy for Florida's 6th Congressional District, Lake County Commission member Anthony Sabatini, whose law firm's address was listed on the filing, confirmed to The Hill that Bill Zerine is running for Congress. Bill Zerine told the Daytona Beach News Journal earlier this month that he planned to challenge Fine, wielding a social media following of more than 30 million on Instagram. Bill Zerine has been known to often post himself with scantily clad women online. The influencer has a history of making anti-Semitic comments, blaming Jewish people for the Holodomor genocide in Ukraine, the assassination of former President John F. Kennedy, the Iraq War, and the mass murder of Christians. He has also criticized Fine, who is Jewish, for comments he has made slamming Islam and Muslims. Bill Zerine will likely face an uphill battle in the solidly Republican district, especially given his criticism of the president. And finally, it's Thursday, which means it's time for the weekly news quiz. Next week, we'll see the arrival of Tax Day, so this week's quiz will analyze your familiarity with the history and details of the day. Be sure to email your response to jgans@thehill.com. Please add quiz to your subject line. Winners who submit correct answers will receive deserved newsletter fame on Friday. For how many years has Tax Day been on April 15, as long as it doesn't fall on a weekend or conflict with a holiday? 36 years, 71 years, 155 years, or 208 years? Which ancient civilization viewed the tax collector as the most noble in society? Mesopotamia, Rome, Egypt, or Maya? Which war triggered the creation of the Internal Revenue Service? The War of 1812, Civil War, Spanish-American War, or World War I? Which notorious mobster evaded the law for most of his alleged crimes but was ultimately sent to prison for tax evasion? John Dillinger, Lucky Luciano, Al Capone, or John Gotti? The story: Jim Whittaker, first American to climb Everest, dies at 97. Jim Whittaker, who in 1963 became the first American to reach the top of Mount Everest, has died. He was 97. Whittaker's ascent to the summit of Mount Everest came 10 years after Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay first scaled the peak. Whittaker died Tuesday at his home in Port Townsend, Washington, according to a statement from his family. His Mount Everest feat made the once shy, rangy climber an instant celebrity, in demand for public appearances and expected to lend his support to good causes, and it gained him entry into the world of celebrities, including the inner circles of the Kennedy clan. He became a close friend of former Senator Robert Kennedy, Democrat of New York, with whom he climbed a 14,000-foot, or 4,267-meters, Canadian peak named Mount Kennedy after the 1968 presidential contender's assassination. Whittaker, who had been state chairman for Kennedy's campaign, was devastated by his death. Bobby Kennedy was one of the grittiest little guys you've ever seen, the 6'5" Whittaker once remarked. It's not how big you are, but how tight you are wound that counts. Whittaker's career on the mountain slopes began when he took on Washington's Olympic Mountains as a Boy Scout, and he once reflected that the beauty and danger of his sport sharpen the senses. You're in nature participating in God's creation. It's such a high, such a spiritual thing, Whittaker said in a 1981 interview. I think it's good to participate in that and to face life, he added. When you live on the edge, you can see a little farther. The risks are part of the game. The mountains are fair and they really don't care, Whittaker noted in 1987. His achievements on the remote snowy slopes of Mount Everest and the nearby K2, the world's second tallest peak, assured him a niche in the record books. He shared world-class climber status with his identical twin Lou, who led the first American expedition to scale Mount Everest's North Face.